Well, I'm going to give you a test. So take out a piece of paper, and it's a test about trials and how trials work. We're going to have a little fun. Matter of fact, this test about trials, some of you may even think is a trial, and I suppose it is. But I'm going to ask you 9 questions. May turn out to be 8, depending upon time here. I want to move along fairly fast. But the first 6 are true or false. The 7th one is a multiple choice. The 8th one has several parts, and it's true or false. And the 9th one is extra credit. Okay. Number 1, regarding trials. When you're first converted, trials are primarily physical trials, and then later, God tries you spiritually. Is that true or false? When you're first converted, trials are primarily physical trials, then God begins to try you spiritually. True or false? This is after you're converted. Number 2. God doesn't want us to have trials because he's a loving father. He'd rather see us have an abundant life. John 10:10. God doesn't want us to have trials, true or false, because he's a loving father. He'd rather see us have an abundant life. Is that true or is that false? Number 3. Trials are only necessary for the people who need character improvement. True or false? Trials are only necessary for the people who need character improvement. Number 4. As you become more perfect, you have less trials. As you become more perfect, you have less trials. Number 5. Some people never have severe trials. Some people never have severe trials. True or false? Number 6. Last true or false before we go to a multiple choice. You should get trials over as quickly as possible. You should get trials over as quickly as possible. True or false? Now, you don't have to turn in your answers. We'll come back. Okay, here comes a multiple choice. The most important thing to do during a trial, I'm going to give you 6 possible answers. A, pray to get through it. Luke 11, 1-8 talks about that principle. Pray to get through it. B, count it a joy. James 1:2 says, count it all joy when you fall into various manifold temptations. Count it a joy. Now remember, the question is the most important thing to do during a trial. C, rely on God. You know, Habakkuk 2:4, and Romans quotes this, I believe, the just live by faith. Or is it Corinthians? The just live by faith, Habakkuk 2:4. So rely on God. That's the most important thing to do during the trial. D, patiently wait for it to end. Patiently wait for it to end. Let me read a verse to you, Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 8. Ecclesiastes 7. And verse 8, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. So, is the most important thing to do during a trial to patiently wait for it to end? Ecclesiastes 7:8. That'd be D. E, see how spiritually tough you are, how strong you are. This is the most important thing to do during the trial, is just see how tough you are. True or false? I mean, would that be the answer? The Spartans used to test soldiers whose courage was in question. They really used to do this. They would have a soldier whose toughness, whose strength, whose courage was in question, stand and face the troops. They would quite literally take a hungry fox, put the fox inside the soldier's kind of blouse, and the fox would proceed to eat the soldier's stomach. This happened commonly. And the test of his toughness was whether or not the troops who were facing him in formation could tell by looking at his face that a fox was eating his stomach. So, is that what a trial is about? See how tough you are, to see how Spartan-like you are. I grew up in Lima. We were the Lima Senior Spartans. Yeah, they were Greek soldiers. F, none of the above. Would you say the most important thing to do during a trial is not pray to get through it, count it a joy, rely on God, patiently wait for it to end, or see how spiritually tough you are? None of those. It's none of the above. Okay. Question number 8 is, look at all five of those again, and are they true or false? Is it true that you should pray to get through the trial? Yes, it is. That's true. Oops, I'm giving you the answer. Disregard that. The jury will disregard what they just heard. I always think that's funny when the jury hears an important fact and they say, disregard that. Should you count it a joy? Should you rely on God? Should you patiently wait for it to end? Should you see how spiritually tough you are? Now, this is the extra credit. Each of the first 8 questions are worth 1 point. The total points are 100. So the last question is worth 92 points. Okay? This is a true or false question. Last question's worth 92 points for extra credit. This was a very cleverly devised test by whoever the author was. If you get that right, you get 92 points to start. I'll give you a clue. I wrote the test. All right, let's go back through the first 8. Now that everybody can't score worse than 92, everybody feels better. All right. When you're first converted, trials are primarily physical and then spiritual. True or false? The answer is false. They are physical and spiritual all through your life, and they're primarily spiritual all the time. And once you have God's Spirit, all trials have spirit overtones, have spiritual overtones. Number 2, God doesn't want us to have trials because He's a loving Father. He'd rather see us have an abundant life. False. Because He's a loving Father, He does try us. That's why He tries us. He chastens every son that He loves. Just like parents who spare the rod hate their son. But he that loves his son chastens him betimes, as the Proverbs say, regularly. Trials are only necessary for the people who need character improvement. False. Because everybody needs character improvement, so therefore it'd be for everybody, and trials are more than just to improve your character. Number 4, as you become more perfect, you have less trials. False. Some of the greatest trials that happen the most often were to the people who were stronger, and God literally, as you grow, progresses you to stronger trials that come more often. The Bible is full of that example. All you have to do, for instance, is look at the Apostle Paul. Look at Christ Himself. He was perfect, but He learned by the things that He suffered. He was always perfect, and the trials He went through were the very worst at the very end of His life. They became worse, even for Christ, and He was always perfect. Number 5, some people never have severe trials. False. There are people who don't think they have severe trials because they don't know how to recognize a trial. But all people who are God's children are tried severely and often. Number six, you should get trials over as quickly as possible. False, not true. And we'll see why later on. Now, the answer to the most important thing to do during a trial, pray to get through it, count it a joy, rely on God, patiently wait for it to end, see how spiritually tough you are, is none of the above. It's none of the above. Now, are those 5 points true or false? They're all true. Yes, trials will test your strength. Yes, you do have to patiently wait for it to end. You can't do anything else. Absolutely, you rely on God, and that would be a close second. You can say, well, that's got to be the most important. No, it isn't. And wait till I give you the most important, and you will understand why I say it, but that's a close second. Do you count it a joy? James says you do. You bet. Do you pray to get through it? Of course, because the only other position would be to pray to not get through it or to not pray at all. And of course, that's not right. So those are all true. We live in an age of people who just cannot be impressed or turned on by issues in the way people were years ago. People used to dialogue around the table, but now they look at the boob tube, even when they're eating, much of the time. I've done that. I've been guilty of that. But when we had our children home, we sat around the table and we talked. We live in an age of people who can't be impressed because they don't think a lot about issues. They're calloused. National issues don't get through. People are used to living with problems they can't solve or understand. What are the people thinking right now? Right now, a few miles away from where the August 10th earthquake struck, and another 7.2 massive earthquake killed hundreds more people yesterday right there in Turkey along the Anatolia Fault as the earthquakes keep progressing west, I guess since 1939. And this time, two massive quakes about 90 days apart, or was it, I think the actual quake came on the 17th of August, not the 10th of August. And now that I think of it, I'm pretty sure it was a week later, so it's less than 3 months. There are all kinds of things that are happening we don't understand. Why are two volcanoes in Ecuador erupting and anticipated to erupt within days and maybe at the same time, and both are great volcanoes capable of doing tremendous damage? One erupts every 300 years, one erupts approximately every 100 years, and it just so happens they're both going to erupt at about the same time, and thousands of people have been removed from villages to safe havens, while the certainty of those volcanoes erupting is upon them. Who knows what's going to happen with Y2K? I don't know if it'll be horrible. I don't know if it'll be next to nothing. I know that every day you get more headlines. One day this week it said half the 911 systems in the United States are not ready for Y2K. The same day the president came out and said, yeah, but this and that and the other is ready, but this isn't ready, and so forth. I don't know. I hear so many conflicting reports about Y2K. That's why I don't speak a lot about it. I don't think it's my job to. A lot of other people are out there giving a lot of people a lot of advice, and I suspect they don't necessarily have a lot of understanding. They maybe think they do. I think I understand enough to know that I don't understand it. And God knows, and we ought to be prudent. The prudent man foresees the trouble and hides himself. It says twice in the Proverbs. The simple passes on and is punished. Might be some basic things that one could do. I don't know. I don't think it's going to be the financial Titanic, as one man suggests. I don't think it's going to be just a blip on the radar screen. Frankly, the likelihood is Y2K, best case scenario is there's going to be so much hype as each day goes on from here through the last 7 weeks of the year that more and more people might hyperventilate and panic and go create a crisis because there's money to be made in a crisis. There's products to be sold at retail. And so it may very well be that the worst thing that comes out of it after the crisis is over, if it's not bad, and I don't know which way it'll be, is that in fact, if it's not bad, people will say, see, all of this crying wolf about Y2K, it was no big deal. And let me tell you, if anybody comes along later and tries to warn people about much of anything of any consequence down the road, it'll be like, remember the Alamo, only it'll be, remember Y2K. That's the way it will probably be. So people live with lots of problems they can't understand. Why do kids go in and just shoot up a lot of people in a high school? Yesterday in Louisiana, a bomb blew up in a restroom. Police charged all through the high school and found four more bombs that hadn't detonated yet. Why do people do that? Why does a depressed father shoot himself after killing his wife and his kids? There's so much going on that people don't understand in government, in geopolitics, in the economy, in how people are elected or not elected. A lot of people just say, you know, we really can't understand life, and people get used to living with problems they can neither solve nor understand. So the answer to the question, what's the most important thing to do during a trial? You literally swim upstream against that national and perhaps worldwide tendency as life grows more and more complex and people are shutting down and no longer trying to understand life. They're just becoming more and more lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. Get while the getting's good. See who can die with the most toys. So the answer swims upstream against that. Here's what you should do more than anything else when you're in the middle of a trial. Ready? Here it is. That you learn from it exactly what God intends. That you learn from that trial exactly what God intends. The first reason for doing that is, if you don't, God's going to put you through it again. So there's a pretty highly motivating reason to learn from it what God intends. Turn to Psalm 119, if you would, please. Psalm 119. We're going to move fairly fast here. Psalm 119 and verse 67. What was David's approach to trials? Before I was afflicted, tried, I went astray, David said in Psalm 119:67, but now have I kept your word. You are good and do good. Teach me your statutes. Verse 71. It is good for me that I have been afflicted. Affliction doesn't feel good. Trials and tests and temptations, brethren, don't feel good. But it's good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn, keyword there, your statutes. Why is affliction good? Why are trials and tests good? Because during those trials and tests, we're supposed to learn. We're supposed to learn. Now, sometimes we're supposed to learn faith. Sometimes we're supposed to learn patience. Sometimes we're supposed to learn financial lessons. Sometimes we're supposed to learn to maybe just shut our mouth. Sometimes we're supposed to learn to eat better, or to exercise more, or to sleep more, to avoid illness. Sometimes we're supposed to learn to forgive. Sometimes we're supposed to learn that a temper can be destructive. Sometimes we're supposed to learn that without self-control, we're going to get in trouble. He who has no control over his own spirit, the proverb says, like a city broken down without walls. You're absolutely defenseless. That's what that verse means, by the way. We don't have to turn there. It doesn't mean desolate. It means you're defenseless. If you can't control your appetites, your desire for things, you don't have self-control, for instance, you're an absolutely defenseless person. Your appetites will overcome you. There's always something we can learn. It might be wisdom. It might be understanding of some kind. Don't assume you know what a trial is about. I remember Mr. Armstrong made a statement. I wrote it down. I've never forgotten it. Because we as disciples could say the same thing in many, many different arenas in our life. Mr. Armstrong said, and this is an exact quote, seven words. He said, I've had quite a course in humility. You know, you take a college course or a high school course to learn whatever that part of the curriculum is about. Well, all of us take courses in humility. Maybe that's what we're supposed to learn. Maybe we're supposed to learn joy. Maybe we're supposed to learn to be more peaceful or loving. More good or more meek, you see. During trials, many people never strive to learn what it is for which they're being tested and tried. You and I are being graded daily. That's easy for a student to understand. A number of your students, that makes sense to you. You know what that means. You're being graded daily. You know that there's a curriculum you have to take. A disciple means a student, a learner. How does God stimulate people to learn? Well, he tests them. Ecclesiastes 7:14 was a key verse in a sermon last summer on suffering. The day of prosperity, be joyful, Solomon wrote. You see, Solomon learned from what his father said in Psalm 119. The day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, that's trials and tests, consider. Now, what would you consider? Primarily, what am I supposed to learn? What am I supposed to get out of this? Look at 2 Timothy chapter 3, please. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Talks about people who are ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. You know, there are a lot of people who are learning, but they don't necessarily learn what they're supposed to learn. Now, be sure when you learn the right thing. Ask God to guide your learning. Philippians chapter 4, a remarkable verse. Philippians 4, Paul was a student on life. In life and on life. Philippians 4 and verse 11. Paul wrote, "Not that I speak in respect of want." I don't have anything that I want. He was talking in verse 10 about people who wanted to give to him, but they lacked opportunity. "For I have learned." Now that tells you right there, before you even read what he learned, that Paul was somebody who learned in life. "For I have learned, in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content." Maybe what you're supposed to learn in some trials is to just be content, to say, "Father, I accept conditions as they are in my life." To be content. Some things are beyond your control, and you have to accept them. I had to do some of that over the last several months. They're just things that were beyond my control. Still are things. There are things beyond your control, and you have to learn from them. "I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound." Look at this verse. "Everywhere and in all things I am instructed, both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need." When the good times were rolling, Paul said, "You know, I'm instructed. I know how to accept abounding and being full." When the not so good times were rolling, when the thin had been, you know, the thick had been replaced with thin, you know, through thick and thin in life, putting it that way, Paul had instructed himself be able to be hungry and suffer need. I've learned. I'm instructed. Do you let life, brethren, instruct you? I think the sermonette even made an allusion in principle to the statement I love to quote. "The only thing men have learned from history is that nobody learns from history." Your life and my life are so much history. Frankly, in one sense, we could make a case for the fact that the history of our life is the most important history of all. It's history we can control. Certainly, we should learn from other history. But you've certainly got to learn from the history of your own life as you're living it. as Mr. Armstrong said, experience isn't the best teacher, but boy, it's a good teacher. It's a wonderful teacher. You've got to learn from the history of your life. We have got to make sure we learn from experience. Have you ever met people, and maybe you've even found yourself repeating the same mistake over and over again, but there are people who never seem to learn anything, ever, you know, at any time. They just don't. Life has stop signs, is kind of the way I put it. You know, you drove over here, and chances are you came to some stoplights and some stop signs. Some people drive through stop signs in their life. They do it over and over again. Now, a lot of people will go through stoplights and stop signs if they're in a hurry and it's 2 a.m. I don't say everybody does, because the law doesn't change at 2 a.m. when it's dark and nobody else is on the road and the stoplight says red, you still stop. You just, some people will tend to do it then because they'll say, well, I can get away with it. I am in a hurry. But some people just run through stop signs and stoplights all the time. That's just the way they live their life. When you come to a stop sign in a car, you're supposed to look around. And then you proceed. A little different than a stoplight. Stoplight is, you stop if nobody's coming. You know, you can't go anyway. Now, if you come to a yellow light, you're supposed to proceed cautiously. It might be a sometimes busy intersection. A defensive driver is going to come to every intersection as though there's a caution light there if they're smart. Because if you don't, you could be killed by somebody else's mistake who runs a stoplight. There was a minister, actually the man who baptized my parents, went through a stop sign. Actually, he did not go through a stop sign. He was driving along a road years ago, and a cement truck ran a stop sign way out in the Midwest and killed him horribly. Instantly decapitated. It was a horrible event. The man had left the church and so forth, was not in the church, but he'd once been a minister. He baptized my parents. And I told my parents that the minister that had baptized them, long after he had left the church, died violently, decapitated, because somebody else ran a stop sign. It was a shocking thing. But you know, I told my father that because my father used to tell me as a child, I think I said this in a sermon one time, son, I have no interest in burying you because you died in the right. It won't give me any consolation to stand over your grave if you don't learn defensive driving and say, well, my son's there in that box 6 feet under, but it's okay because he died in the right. It was somebody else who ran a stop sign, so defensive driving might help you. When you come to a stop sign, when you come to an intersection, when you come to life's intersections, you're supposed to examine what can happen. You face a decision. And you can even be impacted not just by how you make the decision, but by the decision somebody else can make. You have to intersect your decisions with the decisions of others. When you make a decision in a trial, it can sometimes impact others, not just yourself. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1. And verse 5. We are kept, who are kept, by the power of God through faith to salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time, wherein you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, just for a little while, if need be, you are in heaviness, if need be, you're in heaviness through manifold temptations. Now let me just stop and say, you know, there's lots of temptations, lots of trials around. It's heavy. And sometimes you want to break under it. Now, you're not allowed to break under it, but that statement says that your God understands that when trials around you are manifold, there's lots of them, they feel heavier. Two trials feel heavier than one, three feels heavier than two, five feels heavier than three, and so forth. When they're manifold, it feels heavy. And a person says, yeah, I can only handle so much. But God understands that sometimes, for a season, for a little while, There is a need, if need be, and the implication is if God's allowing it, there's a need that you're in heaviness through many temptations, that the trial of your faith, that God is in charge, takes faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes. What's gold going for an ounce now? A lot. Like only platinum is more. So it's pretty precious out there to people who collect, you know, American Eagles and Krugerrands and pesos and whatever else. Though it be tried with fire, nobody wants to be tried with fire. One of the most horrible things I saw yesterday on the news was one house collapsed. There were children in it, apparently alive, I think they were, and the house was on fire. Nobody could get into the children as fire was creeping through. And I read in the paper this morning that there were some slow creeping underground fires, and they were getting to people, and they were just finding people who were just slowly had been cooked horribly by fires that were not close enough to actually burn them up, but just slowly killed them while they're trapped in the dark. A horrible way to die. Look, I know what fire is. You know what fire is. I read a story because this applied to my uncle. I'll tell you the story of my mother's older brother, Dick. He was pulling a cattle truck down to southern Indiana from northern Wisconsin in 1949. And my father and mother were selling calves that my grandfather, my mother's father, would buy and then have his one son drive down, and his daughter and my mom and her husband would sell. Well, he came around a curve, and a car swerved in front of my Uncle Dick, and he swerved the truck, and all the cattle shifted and flipped the truck, and flipped, you know, just flipped right over on its side. All the cows literally jumped out and running all over, but my uncle was pinned, and there was gas leaking all over. And up comes this, you know, bright soul with an acetylene torch ready to cut him out. And my uncle screamed at him to get away with the torch. Well, they didn't get him out in time. He horribly damaged his leg, and finally he had surgery after a long extended illness in a Mayo Clinic, and they just took his knee out, and he had one long straight bone for his left leg. So I was born the year before this happened, and the only way I ever knew my uncle is he had this one leg that was stiff and the other leg bent, and my Uncle Dick was just, that's just the way he was. And yet I often thought of another example of a man who flipped a cattle truck and gas went all over and it ignited, and people were traveling around it rubbernecking while this poor guy was caught in the truck. Read this in the paper, screaming at this policeman to shoot him. And all the people drove by, and of course the reporter was reporting what it was like as this guy burnt to death, and the policeman was standing there crying because he couldn't do it. It would be murder. And they couldn't get him out, and all these people were watching. Now, why do I tell you that story? Because fire is hot. It's horrible. Nobody likes to be burnt. I don't care if you burn your finger on a stove. We're just looking at what the scriptures say. Tried with fire. When God tests people, he puts them in fire. Sometimes just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, you literally feel like you're in a furnace. And it's hot. And as the old saying goes, you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Well, a lot of God's trials are hotter than a kitchen that might have an oven and a few, you know, flames that are being used to cook. But we're tried with fire, and we might be found to praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. You and I have to be able to handle trials of fire. Even if there's lots of fire, manifold temptation in your life. Now, temptation is a downward pull. It doesn't have to be a particularly heavy temptation. When we were kids, we used to play a game with a golf club, my older sister and younger brother, and we'd do this all the time. My parents, we probably guess from the stories I tell, we did lots of games when we were children, but we used to hold a golf club out or a book. We'd hold the book out like that, and we would just see who could hold it the longest. You just hold the book. Okay, now a book wouldn't be very heavy, might be a pound or half a pound. Depending upon the weight of the book, and I would liken this to temptation, you can hold it for a longer or shorter period of time. Any temptation, as long as you continue to entertain it, and you do not defeat it and resist it and flee from it, any temptation given time will cause you to collapse under it. We would time each other and we'd be holding it like this. I'll never forget this as little kids, and we'd see how long we could hold that putter. It was usually a putter, a golf club, or sometimes a book, and just see how long we could go. And eventually you're like this, and you're just, oh, you're sweating, and nobody wanted to lose. And I was the strongest because I was the biggest, but I didn't always win, I can tell you that. And it had, my parents would be the judge as to who was kind of letting it down. You know, Abe Lincoln used to hold an axe. Remember, Honest Abe, the rail splitter, could hold a double-bladed axe, actually could hold two of them, and he could hold them straight out for 3 minutes. Now, that is a long time. But eventually, even if you're Abe, you collapse under the weight of temptation. Temptation is a downward pull like gravity. It's like weight. The longer you hold the temptation, the harder. Now, some people think they can handle temptation. Say, I'm strong-willed. But I'll tell you what, the golf club, the book, the temptation gets heavier and heavier and heavier. And even if you're an Abe Lincoln, eventually you're going to collapse. James chapter 1. So in the middle of a trial, learn what you can as fast as you can, but no faster. James 1 and verse 13. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he any man. But every man is tempted when he's drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust has conceived, you hold the putter out there too long, you hold the book, you hold the temptation, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. You know, when I go into a restaurant, I have learned, because I don't need dessert. I don't eat much dessert. Once in a while, I get a dessert, usually around feast time. My wife doesn't make desserts. She makes great desserts. She just doesn't make them, and it's good she doesn't. But I have learned in a restaurant, I'll just tell you the way I think. I don't know if you're this way, but this is the way I am. Granted, I don't have a problem with if I eat something on Monday, I wear it on Tuesday. I mean, that's just not my body type. So I'm blessed that way. But that doesn't mean that I can't be hurt by eating dessert as much as anybody else. The sugar, the junk, plus the fact that, you know, it's that much more you take in that if you said no you're not as full, you'll sleep better, and a lot of reasons why it's not good to have dessert, other than it puts on pounds, which in my case never happens. But I will just say that I know what happens when I consider having a dessert. The more I think about it, the more likely I am to have it. So I have learned to quickly say no. I'm going out to eat tonight. I might have a dessert. If you're there tonight, forget that I said this. I probably won't. I'm just kidding. I probably have dessert, honestly, about 2-3 times a year. And I really don't think that would be high, other than the feast. I think that's probably about right. It's just that tonight may be one of those times. I don't know. So I don't know. But I will say, you know, if you sit and you contemplate things, you stand in a mall, boy, you want that television set. Oh, man, that would just fit so nicely. It's the right size. And I've got an entertainment set. But you can't afford it. You've already got too much debt. But you entertain it, you're more likely to buy it. You, brethren, determine when and how long you are tempted. Do you know that? You determine it. I've tried to help and counsel, as all ministers have, a lot of people through the years who are trying to overcome smoking, for instance, cigarette smoking. And typically, a lot of people do not overcome cigarettes like that. I've told you that I had two parents who smoked all during my childhood. My mother just stopped on a dime, never picked up another cigarette. She just literally looked at her, she smoked Pall Mall's. She pulled them out and just said, oh, when she read the article on smoking. She'd smoked 20 years. She looked at the article and said, oh, this is wrong. She just put them down, never touched another one. It was that simple. I'll never forget it. I mean, that's incredible control. Took my dad 3 years to quit smoking his Kents. She stopped her Pall Mells right there. And actually, she smoked the unfiltered ones, which means she was more into the nicotine than he was. Now, my dad had self-control in other ways. But, you know, some people don't give themselves a lot of breaking distance. I was counseling a man who was quitting cigarette smoking one time, and I went over to counsel him. He said, Mr. Pack, I've quit. And I got there, and there was a pack of cigarettes right in the middle of the kitchen table. We were counseling over the kitchen table. I said, what are you doing there? I mean, what are they doing there? I thought you said you'd quit. I have. Well, why do you have those cigarettes there? He said, I have them there so I can look at them and tell them I'm not going to smoke you. And I just leave them there as a reminder. I said, okay, fine. I understand what you're saying, but is that wise? Because what if you decide that you're not strong on a particular day? They're only a few feet away. You have no breaking distance. But if the nearest cigarettes are down at the drugstore, then it might take you a long time to go get them, and you have lots of opportunities to gather yourself and stop and say, no, I'm not going to smoke. But if you're right there, that's awful close. I was not as close as one other guy I counseled. He carried them with him. He carried them just to show he'd mastered them. And I said, man, that's the shortest breaking distance I had ever seen. He carried the cigarettes, and eventually I think he stopped doing that. But nevertheless, that's the way some people think. Stay as far away from sin and temptation as you possibly can. Whether your temptation is to take that second or third drink or whatever, whether you have a temptation to steal, there are people, you'd be surprised, who are tempted even in God's church to steal. Whether your temptation is in the sexual area in various ways, stay away from temptation. Whether it's spending too much, whether you're the shop till you drop type, be careful. Don't go to furniture stores and say, if only we had this, if only we had that. Stay away. If your problem is with temper, with envy, with eating, with vanity, with coveting, more subtle than, let's say, some of the other more overt acts, be careful. 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. You know, if you're under tremendous temptation, you know, Christ was in all points tempted, like as we are. He was tempted. If you're under temptation, God will, in fact, deliver you. He knows how to do it. You may not know how to get out of the temptation, and that's where relying on God is tremendously important. Ask God to remove the temptation from you. Yeah, the Bible's pretty plain. When it says flee fornication, it means it. You know, I don't think somebody in the presence of potential fornication looks all that cool, all that neat, all that chic, if they just turned, put their head down, and bolted the other direction. But you know, that's what God says. Literally, if you were in that situation, flee fornication. Who cares how it looks? The important thing is that you don't sin. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And verse 12. Therefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. I can hold this book. I can hold this golf club a long time. Well, I could probably hold a double-bladed axe 3 minutes. Yeah, well, okay, what happens after that? There is no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. Now, let me just tell you that, men and women of God. Whatever temptation you're under, lots of other people have faced it before. And so did Christ, because he was in all points tempted like as we are. There's nothing you're going through that is unusual, that somehow is extra heavy, manifold temptations that you don't have to pass as a test, because sometimes it's just too hard and God knows I couldn't pass these tests. This is just too hot a fiery trial. No, there's no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer or allow you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation Also make a way to escape that you may be able to escape. You have to be willing sometimes to flee. Next verse. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. In Corinth, there were so many idols that it literally was a temptation to fall back into worshiping an idol. Just like next month, some of you will find yourself humming Christmas tunes. I don't care if you've been in the church 2 years or 32 years. You will probably catch yourself humming Silent Night or Hark the Herald Angels Sing or, A Little Town in Bethlehem or whatever. I don't remember what the title of that one is. Because if you're in a mall, you're going to fall back into it. And you know what? You've got to get away from that. I've learned I can't really be in restaurants much after Thanksgiving until into January. Because I'll start humming those songs. And I know the retailers are playing them because they know it puts me, not me, but, consumers, in a buying mood. And you might get the double whammy. You might buy things you shouldn't buy while singing Hark the Herald Angels Sing, if you understand what I mean. I'm being partly facetious and partly serious. Psalm 26 and verse 1. A couple final verses. Psalm 26 and verse 1. A shorter sermon because of the longer sermonette for those of you who will be hearing the tape later. Judge me, O Lord, David said, for I have walked in my integrity. Now, you don't have to say, God, I don't do anything right. You don't be so self-effacing before God that you never believe you do anything right. That's not a right attitude. David was tremendously humble, but he was able to say, I have walked in my integrity. I have trusted also in the Lord, therefore I won't slip. You say, wow, pretty self-confident. No, he actually wasn't. He was very confident in God. Yes, absolutely. But he then went on to say, examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my reins and my heart. For your loving kindness is before my eyes. I know you'll do it in that way. And I have walked in your truth. And he went on to talk about some other things that he had not done that was right conduct. Hard to ask God to try you and prove you. But he has to do that. Jeremiah 10. When you do it, be sure you do it this way. Jeremiah chapter 10. Be sure you ask God to try and test you in this fashion. Verse 23, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walks to direct his steps. You know, when Paul wrote, brethren, that every man and woman has to profess themselves to be a fool, to become wise, this is part of what Paul meant. When Jeremiah was saying, Paul knew this verse, no doubt understood it. You know, it's not in human beings to know how to make decisions, to direct their steps. Do you understand that? Do you understand that left to your own devices without God's help, no matter how savvy, how moxie, how experienced you are, how talented, how intelligent, how skilled, how many times you've been around the block, so to speak, you don't know how to make spiritually good decisions without God's help. So he went on to say, O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. Which is one of the greatest verses on child rearing, by the way, in the Bible. It's not talking about physical parents, but God is a parent. Even the child, David, understood, could not punish him in anger or he'd bring him to nothing. He would just bring him to nothing. I mean, God could break David. You parents could break your little bitty children. Now, most parents don't discipline enough and don't spank enough, and it's getting worse in this age. But I'll tell you what, if you go too far, I mean, you could just kill a little child. I looked at this little grandbaby this week, and just it was just amazing. This little teeny fragile child could grow up to probably be, if you double the size, I think he's the same height as, or the length his father was when he was born, so he's going to probably be a little bigger than me. A little teeny child, but right now he's so dependent on the nurturing of parents, but those parents are going to have to correct him. But not in anger. Parents who correct in anger abuse their children. 7 little kids are killed every day in this country by abusive parents. 7 children are killed by abuse. Hundreds are injured every day by parents who correct in anger. So Jeremiah reminded God, don't do it in anger, but correct me. Trials have to be brought to correct us. More trials, brethren, are going to be coming on the church. More trials are going to come on you. We've been through a trial. God delivered us. God is a righteous judge who defends his church, his people, from foes. He can even, as the song says, treacherous foes dismay. He can do that. He'll send out his light and truth. He will get you through whatever you and whatever I have to get through. He always will. When you have a trial, next time you have a trial, might be later today, might be tonight, might be tomorrow, count it all joy. Count it joy because you now have a clear opportunity to learn what God intends that you learn.